talking about merch right before we recorded this intro, just about like ideas for merch that we want to have. And I think top of my list after listening to this episode just a couple minutes ago was hashtag this bird fucks, just like shirts that say these birds fuck. Because I have thought about this quote in this episode every single day since we've recorded it.
And it's been a while since we recorded it, but same, like this movie, true fever dream, but just like iconic. And Goldie is hot and little rockadoodle man is hot. And yes, these birds fuck. 100%.
Revisiting this film was such a treat, such a delight. I'm just so excited that we're releasing this episode. And we're actually releasing it a little bit early just because we've quoted it so many times to each other. And we're like, we need to release the rockadoodle cut. But yeah, Sarah, I'm so excited that we're getting episodes to people on a regular basis again.
I know. The last two episodes we released were both live episodes that we did without guests. And so this is our first episode that we're releasing that is, like, you know, edited and has an incredible guest who truly made this just kind of the best experience to discuss this particular film.
Honestly, it's been on my mind. Rockadoodle has weighed heavily on my mind ever since we've watched it. I've even been watching the new season of RuPaul's Drag Race, season 14, I believe, just started. And I'm even seeing some, like, not direct cultural references to Rockadoodle, but I'm just like, oh yeah, Goldie would love this. But Rockadoodle is life, like, truly.
Truly. Well, I hope y'all enjoy this absolutely incredible episode. And yeah, make sure that you're subscribed and following us on all our social media channels, because Chloe and I have a lot of time to dedicate exclusively to the pod over the next few months, and we're so excited about it.
Thank you, God, for all this pod. Truly enjoy doing the show and enjoyed doing this episode so much. And I won't say it again, but I will let myself take it away.
Sean
Are you going to be playing Goldie in the new Broadway version of Rockadoodle, Chloe?
I kind of look like Goldie right now. Like, my hair is really short and I'm wearing glasses and I know podcasts are famously a visual medium. I will take a screenshot right now of me just like making a yelling face. We'll put it on the gram. Okay, so I didn't realize how much I identified with this cat until I was seeing myself on camera. Oh my God. You know, famously, I used to joke that I wanted to, like, play Chip in Beauty and the Beast. And I feel like that kitty gives me Chip vibes.
Yes.
Like, just a cute – the cutest voice I've ever heard in my freaking life. Yes. Such an iconic film. But I want to bring in our guests because you can't see them right now, but they're just like, yes, like – fist pumping everything that we're saying and laughing at how much. What is the cat's name?
Edmund.
I look like I could. I'm doing an Edmund cosplay right now. Nick Quintal, welcome to the show.
Welcome.
Hello. Thank you for having me. And I had to jump in. You know damn well that you are peepers.
You know what?
You know damn well.
You're not the first person to say that to me. Peepers, of course, the bow-clad mouse. I feel like I'm an amalgamation of every female character. I was raised by this film. It takes a village of very sexy, feminist icon cartoons to raise a 90s child. And here I am, looking like Edmund.
Nick, thank you so much for choosing this film. This was absolutely one of my favorite films as a child. And I think we're going to talk all about it, but why this film? Why did you go with this one? We had like this whole, you know, holiday theme planned, but when you suggested Rockadoodle, it was
stop
like,
the presses.
Nothing
we
else.
Must
nothing
cover
else.
This.
We must.
Yeah, there's certain like obscure things that felt like a fever dream to me. This movie was one of them. The live action Alice in Wonderland was another one of those things where I was like, was I the only person who watched this?
The TV show.
Eureka's Castle, all of these different things. And once you said Rockadoodle, oh my gosh, Nick, tell us your relationship to Rockadoodle originally.
So Rockadoodle is one of those movies that I obsessively watched growing up. But it's one of those, I mean, we jokingly can call it knockoff Disney because it's Don Bluth, who, you know, we'll get into that later.
Yes.
But
so much history to cover there. So, so interesting. So
but it's just one of those movies that I remember, you know, as a 90s kid, either on VHS recorded, you know, off the camcorder from HBO or that you got from the store, you watched repetitively. And I had some more, I'd say higher level ones that I watched a lot, but this one, I just sat back and went, this is so obscure. I watch this all the time. I have it on VHS at my dad's house. I have it in DVD. I bought it a couple years ago. And it just, it's so good. It's so, so good.
Yeah.
I mean, it's the origin of Elvis for me. It's like, it's, there's just so many aspects to this. It's all, you know, animals in the film, except they're all hypersexualized. There's so much singing, so much color, and like this live action part. It literally has everything. It has.
It gives me a little bit of Cats Don't Dance energy. Like I feel like this film walked so Cats Don't Dance could run, because I remember as a kid, especially as a kid in the performing arts, loving all the like Hollywood behind the scenes of both Rockadoodle and Cats Don't Dance, where you saw like how they did the motorcycle thing. I think that's how I learned like how they filmed different things in Hollywood. And I feel like all the cars and the trailers, I wanted to live in these places. Like there were so many visual references. I haven't seen this movie in probably over, you know, 25 years. Like, but I watched it. I had the VHS. I watched it so many freaking times, and I didn't realize how much I quoted it. I quoted this movie all the time as well, and learned a lot of vocabulary words from this movie. We'll get to it. I wrote down so many of them, but oh my God, like what a visually, you know, the animation style is very interesting, and I have some history to share on it. But what did you guys think? Did you notice kind of the flashiness of the animation? So for anybody who hasn't seen this, this was done in a time of very early animation, and it's a stark contrast to like today's modern day kind of, not even just CGI, but what we consider animated computer graphics film. I think this was all hand done.
I think so too. And I mean, it's, I think the movie came out, I think, was it 92?
Well, it was 91 in the UK and 92 here in the US.
Oh, you know, because I think it originally was supposed to be, it was supposed to be Christmas 91, but they pushed it because that's when Beauty and the Beast was coming out and they didn't want to compete. But speaking of the aesthetic and just the animation and whatnot, I know we'll jump into characters soon, but one note I specifically wrote down, it says, I said, the Duke's magic is Chloe's entire aesthetic.
Oh my God. That was one of the first notes that I wrote, was just like, that is the most beautiful thing I've ever seen. Hearts and stars. It looked like a Lucky Charms commercial, but like so much, it was true magic. And I actually found a note about that in the trivia for this film. So I wrote down so much trivia. I am going to get into it. But the reason that there are sparkles and hearts in that is, so they showed this movie to a test audience. And I don't know about you two, but I could tell that this film had been iterated on. And the reason that I say that is, this is probably my 100th and, you know, 25th viewing of this film. And I couldn't help but notice that the narration really kind of existed to catch us up where we were. And I could tell that it had been kind of added in post. And I also found that out in the trivia that, you know, this had been shown to test audiences and there was a bunch of feedback on things. Specifically, they had to change the champagne to something that just said King and looked like soda, because they would have had to do a PG-13 rating if there was alcohol in it, which is something we just found out about Air Bud, that there was a little bit of, with beer being in the movie, it was kind of on the border, because the TV kind of rules back then were very, very strict for children's television. But in addition to that, they had to edit a lot of Goldie's cleavage,
yes,
because she was based off Jessica Rabbit in a way. And moms complained in the original screenings, like, these titties are huge. Like, why is my child old looking at bird titties. But the magic was made more magic. It originally was just the purple. I was reading, I think it was on IMDb trivia, that they added the stars and the hearts to make it less scary because it was like this, you know, kind of essence, almost like that Little Mermaid voice moment. Like, and they wanted it to be less scary. So they added the magic. And oh my God, when it came back at the end, I was like, it's back. The magic is back.
I will say, Ayla did watch this with me. Ayla's my almost 4-year-old daughter. And, famously does not want to watch anything new. And so usually just like dismisses me when I invite her to watch. But she did watch this and she watches some pretty scary stuff. The owl, the Duke did scare her a bit. And it wasn't until things started to sparkle and, you know, Edmund turned into a tiny cute little cat that she was like, okay, all right, I can do this. But should we do a synopsis of this?
Yeah. Wonderful film? First I want to give a quick intro to Nick to give a little context on how Nick joins us today. So Nick and I used to do musicals together back in the day. We did 25th annual Putnam County Spelling Bee together. He was the barf to my Logan Schwarzengrubenier. And we also did a stage reading of Zombie, the musical, which shows you just how diverse we were as actors. Very. We could play children and zombies. Nick, tell the people a little bit about yourself.
About me, well, if you could not hear from my voice, I am a 30s homosexual.
I love that.
I work as a recruiter during the day. At night, I spend my time playing Animal Crossing and listening to musicals, as one does.
And as far as your knowledge, I feel like you and I send each other a lot of memes constantly of just like Rugrats, and you're one of the very few people who has this very niche, in-depth knowledge. Tell us a little bit about your tastes as a 90s kid growing up. Like, what was culture to you?
Oh my gosh, I feel like you're interviewing me like on Los Culturistas podcast.
Oh my gosh, yes.
I mean, truthfully, I mean, as a combination, Nickelodeon was massive, massive, massive for me. I wanted to be on all the TV shows. I wanted to be on Legends of the Hidden Temple, Guts, Wild and Crazy Kids, but I was also the 90s kids when the resurgence of older movies had come out. Yes. The kid you not, like Mary Poppins and Sound of Music was my shit.
Oh yeah.
My parents told me I wore through a VHS copy of Mary Poppins and they had to buy a second one. And the only reason why it didn't happen with Sound of Music is because those were the two VHS sets.
Right. It was a double VHS. I recall at every hotel that I went to that had it. It was a multi-VHS affair, like Titanic.
Yes.
I feel like I need to send you this, Nick, which for everyone who can see this now, because this is a podcast, it's my Legends of the Hidden Temple medallion.
You know, I thought that was the only way I was going to get to go to space camp was I had to win Double Dare. And my family was too small to go on Double Dare. I was an only child. So I was like, crap, like, I don't have any freaking siblings. I guess one of my cousins is going to have to come on Family Double Dare with me. But I wanted nothing more than to just compete in a giant pile of boogers.
I wanted to be on Double Dare with my family of four. I wanted to jump into the gumball machine.
Oh, yeah.
I wanted to climb up the nose. I always wanted to climb up that giant nose and find that flag.
Yeah.
Oh, man. But yeah, Nickelodeon was my culture.
Yeah. Up. And were you a Disney Channel kid as well?
You know what? There was that weird time in the 90s. I think you guys mentioned this on a previous episode where Disney was, you had to pay extra as an extra cable package. And then like in 98 or 99, it all of a sudden included it in the normal package. And then I was like, give me the DCOMs. I'm going to watch this. But not Don't Look Under the Bed, because that still scares me. But, you know.
Oh, my gosh. Sarah loves Don't Look Under the Bed. Yeah. So you were also watching all of the Teen Witches and the, you know, the Brinks, and you're a big Disney fan as well. Just Disneyland, I know.
Disneyland, Disney movies. I would say that's more the genre that gave me, like, my love for singing and music in aspect. I mean, I can remember sitting in the theaters and watching Aladdin and Beauty and the Beast kind of situation and just being like, what are these? These are amazing. I want to sing all the things. And that turned me into the musical theater person I am today.
And would you say, and this is such a niche musical theater kid question, are you more of an Alan Menken? Are you more of, or do you lean more towards our good friend Stephen Schwartz of Wicked? And or are you a fan of the collaboration of Enchanted? Tell us everything about these composers.
You know what? I'm a good sprinkle of everything. Like I will say I love classics because I'm a sucker for like beautiful orchestration and just like.
And we were just talking before the pod that your dream role is.
Oh, it's Quasimodo and Hunchback.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just, I do not like the actual musical Carousel. Hashtag there's problems. But I mean, if someone plays If I Loved You and just the orchestration and everything, it's just, oh, it's beautiful. But I don't do Andrew Lloyd Webber.
Hot take here. So for Sarah, or maybe for some people who aren't freaking nerds like me and Nick, there is this certain, you know, we're about to do Goofy Movie on the podcast soon. And I feel like the orchestrations of Alan Menken, and Alan Menken is a composer who did The Little Mermaid, Little Shop of Horrors, Beauty and the Beast. The list goes on and on. Just all of the iconic scores, Aladdin. Like this is the music that when you go to Disneyland, your heart just swells. And then we also have our Stephen Schwartz musicals, or Disney shows, I should say, but also musicals. So that's Wicked, Pocahontas. He collaborated with Alan Menken on Enchanted, which was so magical because it was two of the most Disney musicians coming together. But Stephen Schwartz also did Pippin, and you know, it was and Hunchback. Is that right, Nick?
Yes, he did.
And it's such unique styles. Like in the same way that you get to know Danny Elfman with Nightmare Before Christmas and working with, you know, all of this Tim Burton stuff, there's this, you know, musical association with these films, which I have a lot to say about the music in this film.
Moving back to, because you said Little Shop.
Yes.
Back in, because you know.
Yeah. So
Ellen Green is live.
Ellen Green, sexy bird, of course, is the voice of Audrey from Little Shop, is the Goldie from Rockadoodle. But I have a very interesting piece of history to share before we get into the description of the film, which may shed some light on it. So as everyone knows, I have a drama degree. I went to school for theater, and I couldn't help but notice that the name Chanticleer sounded so familiar. So of course I had my little booty to Wikipedia, and suddenly it all clicks to me. So Chanticleer was a play written, I believe, around 1910. And it was by the same playwright who wrote Cyrano de Bergerac, which is a classic, you know, almost in the same level of Shakespeare taught in drama classes. And there's actually a new version of Cyrano de Bergerac coming out with Peter Dinklage, who's going to be playing Cyrano. And the concept of Cyrano is this very popular play in France, I believe, where it was about a person who had a very large nose. And he was courting this woman through all these love letters through a more handsome suitor, essentially. And it's all about, it's almost like You Got Mail. It's the original You Got Mail, kind of. So that play happened, and this playwright writes a second play, like a follow-up, and it's called Chanticleer. And it was about barnyard animals. And it was a commentary on like the bourgeoisie class and politics and fame and all of the characters dressed up as animals. And I highly encourage everyone to do a Google search of the original Chanticleer play from France in the early days, because you know, you see those photos of like back in the olden days, like black and white photos. So like with like crazy costumes from Halloween that are just like horrifying. So imagine, if you will, a very serious play where people are straight up dressed as like chickens and barnyard animals. Like the visuals for this, like, and it's like no one is smiling and everything is like hand painted too, or like one of those photographs where people can't smile because like it takes like 100 hours to take the photo. But it is the wildest thing I've ever seen. It was not very well received, and because it was a commentary on the upper class, and all of the people attending the plays in France were of the upper class, and the reviews mostly said, oh, you know, this is not nice. It's like calling a boomer a boomer, right? Like they're like, we don't like to see ourselves portrayed on the stage. And when you look at the plot on Wikipedia of Chanticleer, it is pretty similar to the plot of, you know, turning off the sun, and the character is a rooster, and there's, you know, a kind of love interest in it that they save. So who knew that this very kind of hip and modern Elvis Presley thing was a famous play?
Yeah, this is like actually all connected, because suddenly a female golden pheasant, and Goldie and Rockadoodles, a pheasant, comes into the barnyard, and Chanticleer helps hide her in Patou's doghouse. And that's his name in Rockadoodle too. Like, this is,
it's all about waking up amazing. The sun as well. Amazing. So like, I always thought there must be some sort of like, it always felt like a fable to me or something, mm-hmm. like Chicken Little or something. But I never understood as a kid, but where does Elvis come in? And apparently the relationship between Pinky and Rockadoodle mirrors that of Elvis and his manager. So apparently he had a not so healthy manager in his life. So there's so many interesting, like, you can tell that the people who wrote this, and like Don Bluth, who we'll get to after the description in a second, you know, really knew his stuff. Like, he was basing things off of like old literature, much like a lot of the Disney films did. But Sarah, I will let you read the description.
Okay. Well, I actually have two descriptions, and I want to read them back to back, and they're pretty much the same, but for different reasons. So the first is kind of the synopsis off of Wikipedia. So the film tells the story of an anthropomorphic rooster named Chanticleer, who lives on a farm and crows every morning to raise the sun. However, he leaves his farm to become a rock star in the city after being tricked by the Grand Duke of Owls, whose kind hate sunshine, into thinking that his crow does not actually raise the sun. Without Chanticleer, rain continues to pour nonstop, causing a massive flood all over the country. The Duke and his henchmen take over in the darkness and plan to eat all of the barnyard animals. Chanticleer's friends from the farm, along with Edmund, a young 6-year-old human boy who is transformed into a kitten by the Duke, take off on a mission to get Chanticleer to bring back the sun and save the country before it's too late. I think it's pretty accurate, but Don Bluth gave his own synopsis that I think has a little bit more emotion behind it. So Rockadoodle is a fantasy, something that we just made up. It's about a character named Chanticleer who thinks that when he crows, the sun comes up. The truth is, it does. Until one day, into the farmyard comes another rooster who fights with Chanticleer and keeps him so busy that the sun, who has a habit of coming up every morning at that time, peeks its little head over the hill. Well, Chanticleer has not crowed, and when he sees that sun come up without him, he's devastated. All the farmyard animals ridicule and laugh at him, so he walks away and says, "I'm nobody." The sun becomes very upset after that and hides behind the clouds, never to come out again. Meanwhile, the rooster goes away to the city and becomes a rock star, very reminiscent of Elvis Presley. The farmyard animals realize they're in trouble because the rains have come, the world's flooding, and there's no more sunshine. So they go to the city and try to bring Chanticleer home to crow.
It was all a dream.
Oh my God.
Such Wizard of Oz vibes, right?
Like, yes.
Such Wizard of Oz vibes in the beginning and the end. Oh my God.
There's just so many things that I think of. Like, the first thing I thought of, first of all, I thought, oh my God, I'm getting nauseous from this animation.
Oh my God.
And the first song.
It was flickering.
But then I was like, immediately Thumbelina came to mind, which makes sense because that's another Don Bluth film. But it was just kind of like this, like, so many things I was thinking of throughout the whole movie.
Once I put together that Don Bluth also did Thumbelina, I was like, oh, it's the same ponytail. It's the exact same ponytail on Goldie as Thumbelina. I was like, same wig. They use the wig again.
Okay, I have a question for you both. I mean, we all saw this a lot as children, maybe Nick the most, but I did not remember that there was a live-action portion of this film.
Oh, I did. Because for me, this film was one of those, like Wizard of Oz, like The Pagemaster, like you know, these films where people went to sleep, went to a dream world. Yeah. They were like, it was real. And I had all these friends. Like, I wanted that so bad. Yeah. And I remember like watching this film and being like, that mom is gaslighting him at the end. Like, all of those characters were real.
At the end, she was, one of my very first notes is, she says, this is one of my pair rants, Nick. I go on rants about being a parent. She says, and this is nothing to do with religion, okay? Though it's going to sound like it does. She says, sit here and pray to Edmund when, like, the farm is flooding and his brothers are outside trying to save it and his dad's out there and she's going to go help. And she says, sit here and pray. And I was like, I was so angry. I wanted to punch her in the face. I'm like, kids know the difference between helping and not. And you telling your kid you are so useless that all you can do is sit here and pray. Like, of course he's going to like go out and do something. Of course he's going to like, I was so angry.
She is an anti-vaxxer. She's like, pray COVID away.
No,
pray
the rain. There's two things on that. Cause I did this time watching it. I paid attention to a couple things. Because at first I was like, oh, when is this supposedly, like, historically take place? And it literally, Wikipedia said, the movie is supposed to take place in 1950s rural Tennessee. So first okay. I was like, okay, that makes sense. But then, and then looping to the very end of the movie, because, you know, she's putting the towel on his head. And I'm like, oh, there's a bucket next to his bed. And I went, wait, is he actually ill and fighting a cold and, like, having that kind of stuff, and that's why she's like, no, get back into bed because you actually are sick.
Is that why I thought this was a fever dream?
Because it literally was.
She wakes him up and she has there's the bowl next to his bed, and she's wiping off his head.
It's Wizard of Oz. It's the end of Wizard of Oz, and there's even like farmers outside that are like, hiya there.
I thought that he like got hurt in the storm.
That's what I thought, but then when they pan out,
but you're
the window
right.
is still there, not broken or anything. So,
yeah.
I think that she gave him some like Tylenol PM, and he was sick,
just
and
go
it was
to
raining,
sleep.
And he just like had an edible. Because literally, I wrote my final note was, he's acting like he had an edible, and I want to put it on our Instagram and just be like, when the edible hits, because he's like, oh my god, what? Where am I? There are all these people. Like, he was just so out of it.
Well, back but then he probably had a Coca-Cola before bed because had the cocaine or whatever. And
that's true.
He was so cute. Like, he was not that I thought he was like handsome, but like I remember as a kid thinking, even as a kid, his voice was just so cute. It was like little tiny baby voice. Like, you really believed he was a baby cat.
I mean, I might get hate for this. When he's a human boy, I hate his voice. Even though it's the same voice when he's the cat, I love it. I think it's so cute. But when he's a human boy, I want to like, I'm just like, shut up. Please stop.
I agree. But, and I think it's because when he's a human, I think he's just saying the lines he's not expressing.
Yeah,
so
maybe that
so
is
his
why.
His face isn't changing. But when he's the cat, he has all the emotions and stuff. And
the animation, like, literally.
Was the cat from Oliver sense. And Company also a kid? Because I feel like I got Oliver and Company vibes from, you know, like, or maybe it was just the fact it was a little kid, maybe because it looked like me, maybe that's why.
No, it was Joey Lawrence in Oliver and Company. He was
that's right.
But the cat motions, like the animation of the cat was very reminiscent of Oliver.
I feel like as someone who's cosplaying the cat, what is the cat's name? I keep forgetting
Edmund.
His name. Edmund. Such a weird name for a cat. Probably because I'm a boy, not a cat. I'm a boy. She has a clean. Like, oh my God. I quoted this film so much. I wrote down some vocabulary words that I know I got from this film. Like, for example, so Charles Nelson Reilly, there's so many iconic voice actors in this. And we've got Ellen Green, Christopher Plummer from Sound of Music, Captain Von Trapp, like, who's a classically trained, like, British actor. Sandy Duncan is playing feminist icon mouse Peepers. Like, this is a star-studded cast, but I watched so much Match Game. I was obsessed with Charles Ellison Reilly. He was just this gay, flamboyant character who'd always be smoking a pipe. He was in the original Bye Bye Birdie. He was in the original Hello Dolly. Like, just a gay icon, Charles Ellison Reilly. Everybody watches documentary. One of the best one-man shows I've ever seen. But I remember loving that little owl. Like, he plays the voice of the little sidekick owl. Hunch. And he was just so tiny and running into things, and I was so obsessed. And there's this one line, let me find it, where he says, how did you do it? How did you kill him? Christopher Plummer's character goes, how did you kill the cat, the young boy? And he goes, adequately. And he was like, and I remember as a kid, like, asking my parents, like, what does adequately mean? And it wasn't until this viewing as a 32-year-old where it's like, yes, it went into a pipe that said adequate pipe. And I was like, that is freaking hilarious, dude. Oh,
it's so good.
Now that I have the context of the Chanticleer, like, original play, I appreciate who they chose as the voice actors, and like the whole, just, you know, like plot and theme and everything so much more, I think.
Yeah, and what was interesting this time watching it, because I hadn't put together, oh, I should also mention that Eddie Dezine, aka Eugene from Grease, plays a Snipes, who I hated and I still fucking hate. I fucking hate that bird. He ruins everything. If he hadn't put the holes in that freaking box, oh my God. Like, this bird is so annoying.
And misogynistic. I also read,
super misogynistic. I hate him. I learned what claustrophobia was from this film as well. And I hated, like, that this bird was claustrophobic because he ruined everything for everyone. But there's so many iconic voice actors. Fun fact, Eddie Dezine has never seen this film.
I was going to say, you know who else he voiced in a 90s, early 2000s cartoon?
What?
Mandark in Dexter's Laboratory.
Yeah, he's done so much voice actor work. I was going through his IMDb, and he truly was on every children's television show that I watched. Like, he's even done, you know, some modern day stuff like Fairly Odd Parents, but he was doing Dexter's Lab. He was on Johnny Bravo. He was on Cow and Chicken. Like, I mean, he had such an iconic voice. Brave Little Toaster. Like, so.
Can we just review all of those right now?
Yeah. Real Monsters. I mean, this guy books.
He just has a good, annoying kid voice.
Yes.
Another one of my favorite characters, and now that I'm seeing who was the voice actor, was the chronically nervous pig as Wikipedia. Will Ryan, who also plays Petrie from The Land Before Time.
That's right. Oh, my God.
Oh, my heart.
Well, and okay, before, without cheating, did you know who the narrator also voiced? Because I was like, this is such a warm, grandpa-like voice that I just love and I feel like I grew up with.
Is it Blue?
It's a famous Disney actor, Phil Harris, who voiced such characters as Baloo and Little John from Robin Hood. All the bears, iconic bear actor. He was in The Aristocats. He played O'Malley. I mean, these like actors, I mean, were in everything. Like, they were such iconic voice actors and just actors of the time, of stage, of screen, and it really showed. Like, Christopher Plummer is a classically trained, like, Shakespearean actor, like, known in, you know, in London on the West End. Like, he's on the level of, like, the Patrick Stewarts of the world, and I thought he did such a great job, because I was terrified of this owl as a kid, but he was goofy but also scary but also terrifying, and it's a true, like, villain, like Scar from The Lion King.
And he was cultured. Did you see that? He could play the pipe organ. He did needlepoint. He baked. He was cultured.
Do you think he was gay, Nick? Got like a gay energy.
Absolutely. He had a band of six owls that sang perfect harmony with him while he played a piano. Absolutely. And a cape.
Adequately. But I just loved all the voice actors. I mean, do you guys remember, like, just this felt like home, like from an audio perspective, like it was like ASMR to me listening to this film.
Yeah, 100%, 100%. I also, like, I think part of the reason why I don't remember a lot of the beginning of the film, namely, like, that there were humans, live action parts, is because it was my, unbeknownst to me at the time, until I was 33 or however old I am, years old, my sexual awakening, because, oh my God, Goldie was hot.
She, like, is the hottest person I've ever seen in my entire life.
And it wasn't until, like, very recently that I realized I'm not straight, because I just thought every, like, especially, you know, woman or, you know, whatever I am, like, envy, whatever, like, thought women were just attractive. And then I realized, oh, not all of them do. How did I not know? How did I not know? Because, oh my God, she is so hot.
She's an icon. She's a legend. And she is the moment.
She is the moment. And Don Bluth, every female character that Don Bluth made, Anastasia, we're talking freaking Thumbelina, we're talking freaking Goldie. Like, these were not Disney princesses. These were, like, girls with tits and booties. And
these,
like,
were women.
Women. Fully shaped women.
Remember the cats? Well, actually, no, he wasn't part of American Tail Five Goes West, but remember the cat?
Yeah.
Yes. Remember that cat with the blush. Oh, I remember it. How did I ever think I was straight? Sorry. Just, like, you know, continued realizations of things.
And hearing, like, a little bit about Don Bluth's background, which I think we should get into now before we go further with this film. So Don Bluth originally was a Disney guy. Like, he worked pretty close with Walt Disney. So you'll recognize a lot of his work in The Rescuers, Pete's Dragon. So he had that experience with, like, live action and cartoon. And he basically started his own independent animation firm. And that included Secret of Nim, which was about Miss Frisbee and the Rats of Nim. He did Land Before Time through Bluth. He did so many different, he, like, worked with so many different, you know, American Tail, this very, All Dogs Go to Heaven. These were just visually iconic. They had this very unique animation style that wasn't Disney, but it was, like, kind of Disney enough that you knew it was legit as a kid. And at Pebble and the Penguin, of course, I feel like I saw that at Blockbuster all the time. Did you guys watch any of these films? Because I felt like that had such a place in my heart.
Literally all of them.
Thumbelina was I had the Thumbelina dolls, and I thought that was the hottest man I had ever seen. Prince Philippe. I was like, this is, like, these movies were my sexual awakening. Like, Rockadoodle and Thumbelina, I was like when Rockadoodle and Goldie are on that couch that is swinging in the air from his house, I was like, this is sex. They're having sex right now.
But Chloe, it's so fascinating. Like, I don't want to just keep saying this, but when I rewatch these as an adult, I remember thinking of me as Chanticleer and as the prince, like the fairy prince, wanting to be dating Thumbelina and
I love and that Goldie. For you.
Because when, like, you're describing it and I'm like, yes, yes, yes. And then you say, like, Chanticleer, and I'm like, oh no. Goldie.
I wanted to fuck Chanticleer, but also kind of wanted to fuck Goldie. Like, she's beautiful, like, she's a gorgeous, just, like, feminist icon. Like, she's Ariana Grande.
Literally.
She's beautiful.
But I think almost every single one of his films, from The Secret of Nim on, so 1982, American Tail, Land Before Time, All Dogs Go to Heaven, Rockadoodle, Thumbelina, Troll in Central Park, The Pebble and Penguin, Anastasia, like, all of those, 100%. Yeah. Some of my favorite films.
And very dark for kids movies. Like,
yeah,
yes.
It didn't play on the, oh, sunshine and lollipops things. It very much is like, I watched an American Tail as an adult recently, probably in the last 2 years. That shit is intense. And I cannot believe I enjoyed it so much as a kid, because it's
about immigration. Jewish it's religious immigration,
child labor laws. Yep. It's nuts. It's absolutely nuts.
And Land Before Time is so depressive.
It's kind of, not grotesque isn't the right word, but it reminds me of Newsies a little bit, where it's like, this is made for kids, but it also has this, like, dark element. Like, you can totally tell that there were edits that were made. Obviously, they edited out the cleavage. They made the magic a little bit more magic. They did things like, you know, clean up. They had to change the alcohol and the, you know, couch scene to make it soda. It just says King on it. But there were so many things that I feel like were just iconic to this world. Actually, one of the trivia facts that I said, you know that scene, it used to scare me as a kid, where the evil owl, Christopher Plummer, the owl, there's like the pig has the apple in its mouth and they're going to cook all the animals. Apparently they cut a scene from it where they were going to cook a skunk in a pie and you like saw it. And I'm sure that they got feedback from like kids and parents being like, that shit's scary, dude. Like, cause that scene scared me without a skunk being baked.
Yeah. The skunk was still live and it was stuffed into the pie and Hunch was clumsy. And so the skunk escapes, but apparently you don't know whether or not Duke is like got that skunk back.
Oh my God. So we were talking a little bit about music in this film, and I have some fun trivia about the music. What were your thoughts about the songs in this film? Because I felt like there were definitely bops in this film, the final song being one of them, the Sexy Time song, another one. But there was a distinct difference between Disney films and this, and I'm curious if either of you noticed it.
Well, I mean, what I know about Disney films is that they have the very specific musical that like template that they follow, right? So there's like all of these specific songs and, you know, tells like stories and stuff. This one felt a little bit more just like fun. And part of that I feel like was because like, you know, Chanticleer is going to go be Elvis now. And so there can just be songs, you know, about things. But I don't know, Nick.
What's very strange is I think aside from the very like end, because it goes into the end credits, I feel like nothing was ever a full song in the movie.
Yes.
Like there were, it was snippets and small clips and things. I mean, Chloe knows, especially from my Instagram yesterday, my favorite song in the entire movie is No Batteries.
Which one is that?
Twiddly-dee, they're running out.
yes.
No batteries. That's my audition song. That's my next audition song.
Oh my God. I vividly remembered every frame and moment of the Under the Sea song with the sharks where they're like, all the animals are in the lobster costume and they jump. That's what I loved about this. It was like a visual like candy for me, because I felt like in Disney films, it was mostly the same backgrounds and stuff. And like, you know, they would walk through a field, but the details of this Vegas world, the city, I guess I don't think they explicitly say it's Vegas, but it's alluded to that it's Vegas. There were just so many little nuanced things in the dressing rooms, or like, you know, you saw all the behind the scenes of the live Vegas show and all the background singers. And it reminded me of that part of Goofy Movie where like, you know, Max like stumbles his way onto the stage and he comes in through the hydraulic and you get to see all the behind the scenes of it. And I loved that kind of stuff. But you probably noticed for, you know, when you guys obviously watched all the behind the scenes stuff for like Disney films, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Where they have the huge live orchestra and it'll be like Lea Salonga, like singing along to Mulan or something. So this film was really, really interesting. The soundtrack was composed by Robert Folk and it was performed by Irish Film Orchestra with songs produced by TJ Koonster. He's one of the songwriters for All Dogs Go to Heaven. And I had this moment and I assumed this before I looked it up. I was like, there's something weird about these group numbers with the frogs and the owls, because there's these two gangs that are sort of the bad guys, right? Like there's the bodyguard frogs who are Pinky's kind of army.
And then there's pop-ups.
Yes. And they're very like buff, like very like, you know, hot main character energy frogs and bullies. And then there's these owls who are kind of the sidekicks, and they all have names, but they're sort of Christopher Plummer sidekicks. So I was watching this and I was thinking, what is different about this than a Disney movie? And then I realized, oh, all of the voices are the same person. Because typically when you hear an Alan Menken piece, like even a Danny Elfman piece, when you're listening to This Is Halloween, everybody has a different character, cartoony voice, but it was like, what a terrible thing to do. And I was like, this sounds like a demo tape that someone made for this. Like, I was like, you know, sometimes when you hear a musical and it's like, oh, here's Lin-Manuel singing all the parts to like In the Heights or something. And I looked it up and that was the case. So there were people singing songs in this, but for those group numbers with the owls and the frogs, where it's like, we're going to beat him up, like just like weird. It just felt like those felt so weird to me. And then when I looked that up and it said, oh, the guy who wrote all the songs recorded every single track in harmony to himself, and it's just one dude. I was like, that's the difference, is we don't have the I need six eggs. Like, there wasn't any diversity in the voices for group numbers.
Oh my God.
As you were describing this, this is a slight tangent, but related. I just looked up who was the voice to the main farmyard bully, the chicken hawk, the minion, the bouncer, Max the bouncer, which is the leader of the bouncer frogs. Okay. So basically the same person voiced the minion of the Duke and the main leader of Pinky's henchmen.
Well, there you go.
This man, Jake Steinfeld, is an American actor, fitness personality, entrepreneur, and producer. And he develops businesses through the Body by Jake brand. And I love this. He co-founded Major League Lacrosse, which is the first professional outdoor lacrosse league in 2001. And the championship trophy is named after him, the Steinfeld Cup.
Also, he was in Ratatouille.
Pretty impressive. Pretty impressive.
Yeah, so much knowledge.
Wow. Wow, wow, wow. This is like a star-studded cast.
It really is.
Oh my God. But yeah, the music, and it was interesting because then I started paying attention more to the music and I was like, oh yeah, they don't have a full orchestra. That's definitely one difference here. The animation style is slightly less professional than Disney. And for these group numbers, they're not hiring multiple voice actors. So they're looking back on these films, and I'm curious, Nick, we'll have to have you back for some of these other iconic Don Bluth films now an expert in it. If that also shows in these, you know, Pebble and the Penguin and Thumbelina, because I remember very similar styles and elements to that.
I definitely think it might, because this is me thinking of even just like American Tail and those movies, because those are the ones I probably know the best out of all of them, minus Rockadoodle. Like, I think of just the group numbers, and if it wasn't one of the main characters singing, I'm thinking of like in Fava Goes West, when Find the Girl You Left Behind, I'm thinking of all the Marquette singing, and I'm like, they all just sounded the same, just maybe little different grunts, but I'm like, no, they were all sounded very, very similar. So that's, I think it's absolutely plausible.
Yeah, and in Thumbelina, I remember, like, honey, marry them all. But it was Carol Channing. Like, it was all these, like, classic stage actors coming together. Oh, my God. We have to have you back for Thumbelina, Nick.
We're
booking it today.
But also, you're right, Chloe. Like, I remember in, like, an American Tale, one of, like, my favorite song was Somewhere Out There, which wasn't really a full song, right? Like, it was... And it's one of my favorites, but it was kind of short.
Well, and you also have to remember, and this is something that I've realized in adulthood, is that every single animated film that you see that wants to go up for award season has to have one song that's their Oscar song. So, like, you'll notice any Disney film, you know, it'll be like, it's usually the song at the end of the Disney film that, like, Vanessa Williams and, like, you know, Andrea Bocelli cover at the end, right? Where it's like, Beauty and the Beast. It's like a very specific version.
And the
reason for that is it's to sell albums and to get awards, because you can only have one song nominated for a film. So when you see Kristen Chenoweth, when you see Idina Menzel singing, you know, Let It Go at the Oscars, like, that's a very, like, it's a very specific ploy. And for Somewhere Out There, I remember that song was huge. I had the sheet music to that. I auditioned with that song as a kid. It was a big American Idol song. So, like, there were certain songs from these films that I feel like were iconic. Not so much Rockadoodle beyond the very niche audience it had, though.
Yeah, you're right, because Somewhere Out There was actually, like, almost 4 minutes long. But why am I thinking that the actual words were just, like, very short?
Because you're probably thinking of just the girl solo, because as girls, I always just want to sing the girl part.
It's true.
So there's a common theme that Sarah and I have noticed in a bunch of these films, and that is the embarrassment of nudity in every film that I see. And we see this in The Little Mermaid. We see this in Camp Nowhere. We see this in The Parent Trap. And I remember thinking as a kid, when Edmund turned into a cat, I was like, this young man is nude. And it made me so uncomfortable as a kid. I was like, oh no.
My other question though is, yes, he's nude, but all of a sudden his you know, his, was it Daniel Boone hat that he had all of a sudden was now kitty size? And did he have a doll or a toy that had it on there? Or how did that happen? Did I miss it?
Did you guys have a lot of problem with scale in this movie? Because in the same way, when I watched Cats, the new movie of Cats, and I was like, wait, are the cats big or are they small? And why is that frying pan like 10 times bigger than them? They're a cat. Are they a mouse? I had issues with this film, and I remember this as a kid as well, where Chanticleer was suddenly really small compared to Pinky. There were moments where the owl was bigger than a pig, and I felt like the sizes of people, like when Goldie is in her dressing room doing her sexy little perfume thing, and I was like, wait, she's a little tiny bird? Like, did you have issues with scale as much as I did?
Yeah, and I think there was a moment where Edmund grabbed like a toy version of his clothes. I really want to say that, but yes, scale was just all over the place. I like constantly, everyone was just growing and shrinking. It was probably the Duke's magic.
Yeah,
like even in the, remember in the beginning when he's going around the farmyard and there's all the, you know, the lady chickens fawning over mm-hmm. him, and he's like 20 times taller than them.
Oh my god! Yes,
they're all. But it's you know what, this loops back into a general theme I think of the movie, because it plays a lot on the, you know, farmland quote unquote poors and the big city aspect, because yeah. I don't know, something, I mean, not to veer off topic, but this always struck me a lot, especially on this last view, how Sarah, when you were reading the synopsis and it said, oh, flooding the world, I'm like, okay, mm-hmm. well, the flooding and everything was happening out in the farmland and whatnot, and then you go to the city and there's no flooding, nothing whatsoever, but the entire time we're in the city it feels like there's never any daylight anyway, but it's mm-hmm. so lit up because of all the lights, God. So they don't notice the issue because it doesn't affect them.
That's so deep. I had never thought of that before, that it's like a nightlife city. And also just yeah. like knowing what we know about the play, the whole commentary on class and like the bourgeoisie of that, like, you know, all of the people back in the town are dealing with, it's like Shrek when they have to get out of my swamp.
Like, I feel like everyone needs to be watching this film right now to understand climate change.
Yes. And,
like, oh my rich God. People need to start understanding that just because you don't feel affected by it doesn't mean there aren't people literally drowning in a flood.
Honestly, this is as much of a commentary on climate change as Ferngully was, as far as I'm concerned. Like, another mass flood.
Yep.
So, you know, have either of you ever been to Universal Studios before?
Yes.
A long time ago.
Okay, you've dabbled. So I feel like, so I love theme parks. I've gone to Disneyland. I've never been to Disney World, but I've been to both Universal Studios. And I've always told my boyfriend about this because I'm such a freaking nerd, that there's such a difference in the magic of like a Disney themed entity or park and Universal. And that's how I felt about this film. I was like, I love this film. It's so iconic. Iconic than some / most Disney films that I've seen animated wise. But it doesn't have that shine or that Disney magic that you would expect from, like, you know, kind of a cartoon like this. Did you guys feel similarly? Because I remember with all of these Don Bluth films, they had a special nostalgic place in my heart, but I kind of knew the music wasn't as good and I knew the animation wasn't as good as a kid, but I still loved it.
I think it goes back to what Nick was saying earlier, though. It's because they, like, these films, in my opinion, are a little bit more like gritty. Like they're a little yes. bit more real. Like we're going to talk about, you know, the actual meteors that were destroying the planet when, you know, the dinosaurs were roaming, and like, yes, families got separated and babies died and parents
Jewish
died.
Jewish people immigrated to America. Jewish on people immigrated.
Yeah.
Cats.
Yeah. Or like, you know, the women who are singing in a Las Vegas show are likely, you know, basically trapped there. You know, like, I feel like there yes. was just, which was both American Tail and Rockadoodle. But yes. I feel like there was just such realness. And I think that's why they hold such an important part in our childhood development, because even if we didn't really notice it, I feel like we knew that it was real. Like, this yeah. wasn't sugarcoating it. Whereas, like, you know, yes, Little Mermaid and Beauty and the Beast were so fantastic and, you know, beautiful and songs and all this. And I absolutely love them, but it was not real.
I mean, Patu talks about his bunions in this film.
Right.
Like, like, it's a dark, weird film. Also, I wrote down the lyric, "Death to Patu," sung by the same person in five different octaves. I was like, they want to kill this dog? Like, what the hell? Yeah, definitely gritty, for sure. Like, a lot grittier than a Disney movie, which is, I think, why I liked it. Like,
yeah,
obviously, my sexual awakening, like, both Goldie and Rockadoodle.
It's for the same reason that I'm so mad at the mom in this film. Is, like, you know, Edmund knew that she was just telling him to, like, shut up and pray and wasn't actually having him be helpful. We knew that, you know, you can't just marry a beast, and yes, that the people who are big and scary looking are probably big and scary.
I feel like Rockadoodle gave me, like, Gaston energy. Like, you know, you couldn't think Gaston was hot. I do now. But, like, you couldn't like Gaston because you're like, this guy's dick. But he had that, like, same, like, build. And I was just like, oh, my God. Like, when Goldie's cuddling with Rockadoodle on that freaking couch in the sky, and then a frog butler bodyguard lowers down sexy – we knew it was champagne. They changed it to soda, but I knew it was champagne.
I always thought it was milk. I was like, it's milk.
I had such a little lady boner for Rockadoodle. I was just like, this – I want to cuddle on this man's chest. Like, I want to be Goldie. And you have to understand – I'm sure I've told Nick this story, but Sarah, I've not mentioned this on the pod before. When I was a kid, when kids were playing Pocahontas, when kids were playing different games, I played Little Shop of Horrors. So I lived on a neighborhood block with all girls and one little boy next door, Evan Santos. And this poor young man, Evan Santos, I would make him play Seymour every time. The three little Jewish girls who lived down the street would play the three urchins, and I would be Audrey every single time. And for people who don't know, Audrey is basically Goldie and voiced by Ellen Green, the original Audrey from Little Shop of Horrors. It is very sexy. She always had her boobies out. I'll post a picture when I cosplayed her at DragCon. It was the most exciting day of my life because she was my dream role. All I wanted to do was play Audrey. My parents took me to so many dinner theater productions of Little Shop of Horrors growing up, and I loved the movie. And the movie was so dark and grotesque, and it was Alan Menken. So, like, it was everything that I loved. I, of course, when I grew up, found out why I loved Goldie so much. I was like, oh, it's Audrey from Little Shop. Like, this is Ellen Green. But this was just in so many ways defined what feminine sexuality was to me, like what it was to be sexy, because I can't think of any other film. I mean, I wasn't a Roger Rabbit fan, but like, this was a bird too. It was a sexy animal. Yeah. I mean, were either of you hot for Robin Hood, the fox?
Yes.
Okay. So you get it. Yeah. Sexual.
Yeah. He was just so slanky and just smooth.
I was just listening to what I consider our sister podcast, the Hold Up podcast, with my good friend Molly Sanchez. Shout out to Molly. It's a great podcast. Everybody check it out. We're going to do a crossover episode soon with them, I'm sure. But Molly mentioned this concept that I hadn't thought before and I was thinking about with this film, which is, you know how at the end of Aladdin, Jasmine has that like sexy red bikini moment, and it's sort of like the slave Leia thing? Like, there were these like little glimpses in cartoon and animated children's films of like sexuality that stood out to me so much as a kid. Like, and we were attracted to Robin Hood, and like, you know, like there were these kind of animated hotties out there. We talked about all the hotties of Jonathan Taylor Thomas and Simba. What a hottie. I mean, another
there were hottie. So many. Roxanne from a Goofy movie.
Oh my
movie.
God. Oh. Yeah. Max. Okay.
Lola Bunny. Are you kidding me?
Starts out with a sexual dream. Correct me if I'm wrong. Like, opening a Goofy movie is a wet dream.
Yeah.
Like, these animals were boning. Or at least getting boners. I don't know if they were.
And not to mention in this movie too, when Goldie, when she first comes on stage to like seduce him, she does her little shimmy dance thing and like literally grinds up on him.
Yes.
And she makes out with him before he sings. And you're like, oh my goodness. Oh my God.
I was attracted. Like, I replayed that part so many times because I just loved looking at the animation of his eyes like bugging out of his head. And he instantly falls for Goldie, and I don't blame him. I fall for Goldie in that moment.
But you know what? What really proves that I was a homosexual back in the day, when they are doing the swing scene in that song, I can clearly remember I wasn't about the whole like, oh, they're falling in love, whatever. I was just like, wow, they're singing so beautifully. I want to sing this with someone. I kept wanting it to listen to them sing, not watch them fall in love. But I always liked Goldie's harmony.
I wanted to ride on the shark. I wanted to sit on the shark like the cat and ride in a circle. And I loved the swings at any state fair because I was like, oh my God, I'm on the shark.
And I just wanted to hold Goldie and protect her with my life.
Okay, I love this. Like, I love this for us that, like, you know, we were all lusting after different elements of this scene. I just wanted to cuddle Rockadoodle. Oh my God. It's so funny that you mentioned earlier, Nick, that like my aesthetic is that sparkly heart star magic that the evil guy does, because I wrote the note, he barfs magic. That's cute. I love all the magic heart sparkles in this film. And I was so glad that it came back later because I was like, this feels like a blanket. Like, this is just like so, it's like looking at candy.
Do you notice that all the, like, a lot of the water scenes and stuff, it's sparkles. That's the magic of them. There's so much sparkle throughout this whole movie.
Did you notice the animation style? And I encourage everybody to watch this back. And it's, I watched this for free on YouTube Video. I didn't even have to pay for it.
I think I watched it on Tubi, which was also free.
So if you go to the scene where Goldie is in her sexy little trailer, oh my God, just like the sexiest moment of the film. She's putting a little perfume on. It reminded me a lot of the scene from Five Goes West with like the sexy singer girl, same kind of energy. There is this moment, she's wearing this kind of contoured bodysuit, very RuPaul's Drag Race, you need to stop wearing bodysuits on the runway kind of moment. But it's very form-fitting, her little boobies are out, but the glitter on it, you can actually see the pattern moving around the glitter, and it's very clear that this is like a new animation style that they're trying out, and it really does, it's real glitter and it looks like glitter. And when I was looking at reviews for this film, you know, it kind of got panned. It kind of was like, oh well, this is a low budget version of a Disney film, it has a lot to desire in terms of the songs and everything. But it did get a lot of call outs for some innovations in animation that were happening, and I think that's really a testament to like Don Bluth. He was, you know, being experimental post his time at Disney, and like there's so much like detail to this animation that you don't see anymore. You just don't, like, I'm sure you both noticed that in a lot of the group scenes where typically in a Disney film there would be like movement, or in the modern day film there wasn't as much like background movement, but I did notice little subtleties. Like there's a scene in a restaurant where they're using the phone book to look for Chanticleer or something in this diner, and there's these two giraffes in the background who are clearly wearing these like Las Vegas touristy hats, and it's just a really small touch, but you just notice like little props in the background, or the details in the cars or the trailers. Like, were there any visually stimulating things for the two of you in this film that like took you back?
I mean, I think the water animation when they're like first leaving the house was one. I feel like a lot of films in this time had very similar, just kind of, it's like one, it's not really water, right? But it's that early 90s water animation where it's all dark and it splashes up and it looks sharp. That, and then I was just, I wanted that trailer so bad.
I wanted to live in it.
Always wanted to have a trailer with like a hot tub on top. I still do. It'll happen someday.
It reminded me of I Dream of Jeannie, like inside the bottle. Like I was like, I just want to live in like a tiny little car. I mean, maybe that's why I want one of those like vans now to go camping in. I want a tiny house in a car.
I mean, one of my notes, I said, I wanted that trailer so bad.
Yeah.
Yep.
But I also wanted the golf cart and, the 12-wheeler caddy.
Yes. I think we need to just like live in this film.
We need to live in this film.
I think we would all be very happy if we could just live in this film. Where is the Duke? Can you please convert us into some sexy animals?
Oh my God.
Right now.
My favorite toys growing up were the Barbie like airplane, the Barbie RV, the Polly Pockets, like things where there were tiny little houses, and like I wanted to live in every single location in this film. I still do. Like I I want there, what is that one car? I guess it's maybe the golf cart that Pinky is in, and he's picking up Rockadoodle, and then it turns into a helicopter and he's like holding him out of the window. I was how do I get this pink car? I need it.
You know what? Also iconic, and this is gonna be the young fat kid in me talking. Did anyone else just want to eat the lasagna?
Oh my god. Yes. Oh, hell yeah, dude. Hell yeah. Speaking of lasagna, anytime that I hear, I realize that I say lasagna weird, and I think it's because of this film. I hated that fucking bird. What's his name? Snipes?
Snipes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Snipes needs to be put in jail. I think he's so annoying. He is that annoying person. And I did write down one of his quotes that made me laugh, which was someone says, "Starbird," or I think it's the little mouse, Peeper, says, "Starbird ho." And he goes, "Starbird who?" And that made me laugh. but he was so annoying to me in the film. And he just always got in the fucking way or was too loud or like poked a fucking hole in something. I hated him.
Yeah. And he also had he made a comment and he goes, "Oh, well, it's because she's a woman."
Yes, and he made fun of her lisp. And then Peepers has this iconic line. Shout out to people with speech disabilities. She was like, "Actually, my speech impediment makes me special." And as someone who played someone with a lisp in Spelling Bee with Nick, I feel like that was a very proud, iconic feminist moment speaking out for people with lisps. I loved it.
I wrote that note down, but I also just love that in the Wikipedia page for these characters, for Snipes, I like this line that says, "Snipes is more interested in exploring the city and its sights than actually helping his friends." And then for Peepers, it says, "She has a lisp and very round glasses and is constantly arguing with Snipes' chauvinistic views."
Honestly, Snipes is a little bitch. Like,
yeah.
But you know what? I will point this out though, because in my opinion, Peepers is not completely innocent, because throughout the movies, she constantly is calling out that "don't be a sissy, don't be whatever."
Yes, yeah.
I'm like, all right, I know you are a strong, independent woman, absolutely, but we don't punch down. We lift up, and you know, it's a combination of like that. You know, she has to be so strong because she has people like Snipes that are degrading her all the time. But again, she thinks like, "Well, I can do it. Why can't you?" And that's not how real life works, kind of situation.
I think that's why I really like Goldie as a character, to be honest, because she reminded me of the cat in Feifel Goes West, where it's like, this is my life. This is where I am. You know, I'm stuck here, but I'm going to try to make the best of it. I'm going to try to be confident in myself. And when I do see an out, I will take that advantage. I will, you know, get out and live my life. And she's just like so true to herself. Whereas I totally agree. Like Peepers kind of takes it to the extreme. Like she's been so hurt that now she has to be mean, which is not true. Right.
I feel like when I was a kid, I didn't know what human trafficking was, but I felt like Goldie was being human trafficked. 100%. And I was like, she's having to perform against her will. Like what? And I also got that impression from American Tale with the with the singer girl, that she was having to sing against her will. And it's sort of this like Joanna from Sweeney Todd aesthetic, where it's like this trapped ingenue damsel who like has to sing, and it's like, oh my God.
But Chanticleer was also being forced. Like, yeah. I think the women in particular from both of these films, like, yeah, it was, I think it's a commentary on the time of like, you know, these films were made in the 80s, but like we talked about, they were talking about, you know, older, and yeah, women didn't have a choice, right? Like you couldn't just be like, "Well, I'm just going to go do whatever."
Yeah. And yeah. Pinky actually says a line to her, because when he's trying to convince her to seduce the king, he basically says, "Well, you can always quit show business." And she goes, and she looks like kind of horrified. And I'm like, she knows that he's been trying to make advances at her. And he's basically like, "Yeah, I'll make you mine. And you'll be my sugar baby." Like that's the vibe I got from that.
Yeah. It's like 100%.
Erica 100%. And Tom Girardi from The Real Housewives. It's like, "I own everything that you make." That is such an interesting commentary, because they're both kind of trapped under their contracts. And I remember, like, you know, we read now about people like Judy Garland, people who were under these studio contracts and just like truly kind of being owned by their manager or producer of the studio. And like, you know, a lot of singers as well, like fuck Scooter Braun, obviously. Like it really does speak to the industry, which we only see that a little bit in some kids films. Like, I feel like the Wacky Deli episode of Rocko's Modern Life is kind of a peek behind the scenes. We have, you know, things like this, but oh my goodness. I also wrote down the swing set is sex. Like that scene, I want it. First of all, that house is iconic. Like, I remember it making sense to me as a kid, where Patu gives the, like, there's some sort of narration that goes, you can take the boy out of the country, but you can't take the country out of the boy. And that he had built this little, like, almost Vegas like light up oasis of what was back home. And I got it. Like, it clicked for me as a kid, like, oh yeah, he made a lot of money now, and now he lives in a penthouse, but he still likes, you know, the farm, and he's about to bone this woman suspended above it.
Did you also catch in that moment that, you know, Edmund goes trying to yell his name, and Patu's like, oh, he's, you know, he's never gonna hear, he's just out miles away. And he goes, what are you talking about? He's right there. And like, Edmund is so young, he doesn't understand sex or sexual attraction or love in any aspect. But Patu is like, no, it's there. Also, how did they get on the swing?
Yes.
They're birds.
There was something so, like, cool and sexual about a swing, because remember, like, in Country Bear Jamboree, where that fucking bear would come down on the swing and you'd just be like, this is an icon of femininity. Like, there was something so interesting about swings at this time. I mean, maybe that says something about me. I don't know. But it was just so, like, I remember, like, that swing was everything, and I wanted to be on that swing. I want to be it, just buried in Sean DeClair's chest. I took pictures of this, like, not for pornographic reasons, just, like, to put on our Instagram to be like, this is sexual chemistry. Like, those birds, that bird fucks. Like, you can tell that they boned.
Cock-a-doo, what a day, I'll tell you.
Very.
Okay, bad. I have a couple of just, like notes that are just totally random, but I just have to say them because there's not really stories behind them, but like the knife claws on the back of that, whatever kind of evil dude, farmyard bully, chicken hawk, terrifying, just terrifying.
Yeah. Oh my gosh.
I forgot how sad I got watching how sad Chanticleer was.
Yeah.
Like, when he realizes that he doesn't bring up the sun, and he just, like, is so sad, and then, you know, everyone else is just laughing at him, and then he's, like, in Vegas and, or, you know, wherever, and he's just so sad, and it just, it made me so sad, so sad.
You know, and that part where you guys are both Disney freaks, so, you know, in The Lion King, where it's like, I can tell what's happening, what? And they don't have a clue. That energy, as well as thank you for finishing it. But it was also like something there that wasn't there before, where Chip's like, what, mama? Like, it's like Disney's version of that is like, oh, they love each other and you'll learn about it when you're older. But Don Bluth is like, they gon' fuck. These guys gon' fuck. It's like no alluding to, just let's get it out of the way. We know what's happening here.
Oh my God, who are these bouncers? Because I looked down at my phone to, like, look something up, and then all of a sudden looked up, and I was just like, oh my God, who are these bouncers?
Like, the owls and the frog bouncers are just bouncing, literally bouncing so much, and that's why I Googled, like, was this added in post? Like, to add more context, and why is it all the same voice? Like, it just felt so fragmented to me that I was like, who are these frogs? And they never really come back.
Of course, the bouncers would be frogs.
Oh my God, of course. Oh. Of course. And they're all like, I mean, they're these buff frogs, but they come out of freaking nowhere. And it's like, why did they get a song? Like, what's happening?
Well, why are they in turtlenecks and crop tops?
They are in crop tops. That's so true.
And also, did you all realize that Pinky was a fox?
Yeah. I thought he was a possum.
I could not figure out what he was. But I just looked it up, and he was a fox. It kind of makes like sense. Fox in the hen house, like, you know, and foxes and owls, you know, do actually eat.
I also noticed that
animals.
One of the reasons that I think those songs sounded so fragmented was not only was it one guy's voice, but it was all MIDI keyboard. Like, all of the stuff with Chanticleer in Vegas so clearly had a full orchestra and a band because it was like Vegas show style. But suddenly, like, anytime those group moments happen with these like weird bouncer animals, like frog or owl or otherwise, it was like, this is weird. And then the music's like, boop, 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 like very, you know, children's musical theater vibes and energy.
Yes. Side note too, did you see that there was a, you know, when movies, they can't put like an actual company name and they'll change it kind of whatever.
Yes, yes.
Did you catch which one they did in this?
Ooh, which one?
They put Dairy King.
You know what? Okay, y'all, I Googled Rock-a-Doodle toy because I was like, I feel like I had a Patu action figure, and I certainly did, and it was from Dairy Queen. Dairy Queen had Rock-a-Doodle toys. My parents used to take me to a lot of antique stores when I was little, and I would collect a lot of like Disney figurine things, and I had the Patu one. I can literally feel this plastic in my hand. Like, they were these heavy rubber toys that they would sell these things at like Disney store all the time, where it would be like all the Peter Pan set, or like it was like this heavy kind of rubber resiny kind of consistency. And I had a couple of these action figures. I think I had the Edmund one. I think I had Patu. And yeah, Dairy Queen. I didn't go to Dairy Queen that much, so I didn't have all of them. So that makes sense.
Yes, I had the Patu for sure.
But like, so then did Dairy Queen just be like, but you can't actually use our name?
Maybe that's how they sold it. We're like, we mentioned you in this, okay?
No, seriously, like, I feel like that's what they must have done, right?
Because Nick, we just watched Air Bud, where it is so obvious that SpaghettiOs sponsored that film. Like, SpaghettiOs is a main character in Air Bud.
Is there credit right below the dog in the credits?
I mean, they don't even need it because the cans are in full view and he makes a shape of a dog out of SpaghettiOs in it. It's truly another iconic animal film.
Wow.
So, Nick, you mentioned that your dream role is Quasimodo in Hunchback of Notre Dame. My dream role is, when Broadway does Rock-a-Doodle, I want to play Goldie. But I will also settle, depending on what way they go with the role, because I'm more of an ingenue. I don't have big titties. I don't think I have the body for it. So I would like to opt for playing Edmund as well. If they go the route of an adult playing a child, I will also accept the role of Edmund. And Peepers. I will also put down Peepers.
And if they just do a child, I'll put Ayla up.
Yes, please.
For Edmund.
Yeah, we will now have Ayla be the, you will become the stage mother we've always wanted you to be.
Yes.
Oh my gosh. Oh, and you know what? And something I wanted to loop back to, because we joked about this throughout this chat, but did you notice, so at the end, when, you know, they're trying to get him to crow and save the day and whatnot, do you notice that Edmund goes, Chanticleer, Chanticleer? And then Peeper starts, she goes, Chanticleer, Chanticleer. Like, nobody knows how to say his name right.
Oh my God. Chanticleer. Oh my God. My neighbors think I'm probably like a stressed out cat right now. I think that just so many, there's just like so many iconic moments in this film of like joking about pronunciations and like plays on words and like, oh my God, the motorcycle. We have to talk about this motorcycle. This scene, I didn't remember it until I saw it, but when they're on that motorcycle and then there's like the background that's spinning that makes it look like they're actually driving, and then he drives the motorcycle off the set, like, oh my God, I don't like action. Like, I famously cannot sit through a Marvel or Avengers kind of thing because I'm like, they just like jump and punch each other. But I remembered all of the action sequences in this scene the same way that I did with Cats Don't Dance, because so much of it is backstage or film lot studio. Like in Pee-wee's Big Adventure, there's that iconic scene where they're riding the bike through all the different film sets. And I loved that like glimpse behind the curtain. And it was clearly made by people who knew that world.
I think that's what it is, though, right? I think that's the difference between, like, these films and, you know, the classical Disney films, is that, again, it's that honesty to us as children. Like, we know that films aren't real, and this is what that behind the scenes is. It's like breaking the magic is almost even more magical, because then you actually, I feel like then you actually feel like you could be a part of it. Whereas when it is true magic, like, I'm never gonna actually be a mermaid. But if I knew how like a person played a mermaid with things, I could actually be a mermaid, you know, like, I don't know.
Oh boy. But yeah, I'm Claire. I'm the same as you, as though that I remembered all the action sequences. And I remember, I will say, watching it as an adult now, there's one specific moment where I was just like, Oh yeah, as a kid, I knew this was wrong too. When Peepers dislodges the trailer from the car, why is it that as soon as it's released, instead of the motion of it continuing forward, it all of a sudden excels completely backwards? And then the tail end is halfway up the thing. And then Edmund goes, I think she's up there. I'm like, she's down here. I remembered as a child, I never understood how it went backwards that way when it was moving forward.
I have a feeling a lot of this was cut out or edited in post because, you know, like I said, when I researched this, it said that Patu's narration was added in later on just to like give more context for what was going on. And I have a feeling that maybe some things in this film were a little too gruesome or gory or like, you know, that they had to kind of edit down because I always got the impression watching this, even as a kid, that it was an incomplete film and that like there must have been, I don't know if y'all noticed at the end during the credits, they play this song where Patu sings about tying his shoes. And yes. I was like, oh, clearly this was like a cut moment. And I'm glad that they cut it because it sounds stupid. But they were probably like, oh, we had this like famous voice actor sing this song about shoes. Let's put it in the credits. Cause like, you know, I bet there was a lot on the cutting room floor for this cartoon.
Just sad. I would love to see.
Right? Release the extended cut, Don Bluth, please.
I want the full soundtrack of Goldie singing all the things.
Oh my God. So here's a quick little quote from Dave Kerr of the Chicago Tribune. Criticized the film's overwhelming amount of characters and subplots, as well as its frantic altering in pacing and tone. However, he acclaimed the hand-drawn animation, calling it superior to the shabby rotoscoping techniques of Beauty and the Beast in 1991. So I totally agree with that. I feel like there was such a level of detail to this that, like, yes, it wasn't at the caliber of a Disney film, but it was still, like, beautifully done in such a like nostalgic animation way that we do not see anymore.
Yeah. But to the first part of that quote, I feel like he did not let himself just watch the film. Too busy like trying to figure it out. Like, don't try to figure this film out. Just experience it.
Yeah. Absolutely. Here's another fun fact that I found. The final scene's blending of live animation with live action with animation was inspired by the popularity of Who Framed Roger Rabbit. Similarly, Goldie the Pheasant's sultry appearance was slightly based off of that of Jessica Rabbit. As shown in one of the earlier trailers found in the original 1990 VHS release of All Dogs Go to Heaven, Goldie was also originally given large cleavage, identical to that of Jessica Rabbit. However, after mothers and test screenings were scandalized by how outrageous her proportions were, Bluth animators were ordered by Goldcrest Films to censor Goldie's cleavage. Free the cleave! Free Goldie's cleave! We want to see the extended cleavage cut. Just how there's a butthole cut of Cats, we want to see the cleavage cut of Rockadoodle. I'm sure you agree, Sarah.
Oh, 1,000%. But also, I think I found a hand-painted version on Amazon. Oh,
I would be very careful. I would warn everybody, if you Google Goldie, there are some fan art, sexy images of this bird that are alarming. And I don't blame people.
Don't know. This says it has a certificate of authenticity from Don Bluth Studios artwork. Oh, and it's boy. 275. Like, I don't know that I would trust buying this off of Amazon, but also, wow.
Wow. Okay. I'm going to click on this.
There's the boobies.
Wow. That is iconic. I don't see an issue with it. Mm. I do think I would have been staring at her titties the whole time, but I welcome it. I welcome this addition to the show.
But Chloe, speaking of Goldie, though, would you cosplay in her finale outfit in her farmyard shorts overalls?
Oh my God. Oh my God.
She was so cute in that
she
outfit.
She looks like Trixie Mattel in the red outfit where she's got the books and the apple on her head. The reading challenge from All Stars. She looks just like Trixie Mattel. And I literally paused it and I was like, I need this outfit. Like, I would wear this. It's so freaking cute. I'm like, look at her. She's like not hoeing anymore. Like, but she's still being her true ho self. Like, I love that for her.
I think you had blue overalls, short overalls. At some point,
yes,
you wore them with some kind of pink shirt during spelling bee rehearsals.
Oh my God. I mean, thank you so much for comparing me to Goldie. That's like the highest compliment. Like, thank you so much.
I think that what is true about Goldie is her confidence. So yes. You can cosplay her in any of her iconic outfits, Chloe, and you will pull it off.
Oh my God. Thank you so much. You're both in my will. Yeah, I need an Ariana Grande ponytail wig situation. Yes. Actually, Thumbelina wig. Like, totally Don Bluth using the same wig on both of these actor animators. people.
Just be like Rue McClanahan in Golden Girls when she's dressed as the chicken. It just make it a little more sexy.
Hell yeah. Oh my God. By the way, I found a very funny piece of trivia on IMDb. One of Edmund's lines has been commonly misinterpreted by modern audiences as, "Jeepers, I'm a furry." He actually says, "I'm all furry," but Toby Ganger's speech impediment has led some to believe he's referring to the then still developing furry community.
Correct. I've always thought he says, I'm a furry, is what I've always thought he said.
Oh my goodness. I mean, there's so much to say about this film. I feel like we've covered so much. I forgot that the little owl became little BB at the end. Like, another thing about Forced Perspective here, I was like, wait, but he is an owl, so he is pretty small probably. Did you guys remember the end of this movie? I think I remembered the finale where they're like, we're back and everything's great again. It's like very end of Zippity Doodah at the end of
Splash Mountain
energy.
I definitely remembered that, like, Goldie in her farmer outfit. Of course I remembered that. And like Edmund, once I saw the ending, I do remember Edmund as a little boy and having that mixed media, like live action and animation together. It was very like Mary Poppins.
It made me laugh so hard watching him live animated because it was still in that era where cartoons weren't that seamless with live action.
Yes.
And I just kept picturing this kid in front of a green screen going like, yeah, and just like pointing and just like them being like, okay, so there's going to be a chicken over here and there's going to be like a weird little mouse. And like, here's kind of a rendering of what it looks like. Just like point to the camera and just be like, yeah.
And then they're like, this is where you cartwheel.
Yes, this is where you cartwheel 100%. I was like, yeah, do some tricks for us, little boy. Dance, monkey, dance.
I wanted to sit on the gate, that gate part where he's sitting there and it opens up. I was like, I want to do that. Can I sit on the gate? That was fun.
Oh my God.
Actually, you just made me realize every single time I come across a gate that can like sustain me, I do that. And it's from this film.
Yes. So many like iconic, like, you know how they, when we were little, they had those like plastic race car beds from Fisher Price.
Yeah.
So I could never understand as a very like girly pink girl why I wanted one of those. And I now realize I just wanted a car bed from this movie. Like, yeah. I was like, there is a fucking car with a bed in it. And I want to bone Rockadoodle in a car bed.
Rockadoodle, more like cockadoodle.
Oh my God. Truly just like the sexual icons in this film. I cannot.
Legends.
Any other final thoughts about this film? I mean, of course, we wake back up in the dream world post Wizard of Oz kind of sequence of a literal fever dream this child had. I didn't look at my watch one time during this movie. Like, I even rewound some parts because I was researching things on my phone and I wanted to make sure. I was like, oh wait, it's a scene with like an Elvis musical number. I need to watch every single detail. And I'm so glad that I did, of like how the set was made and how all the shenanigans with them and the lobster and the penguin costumes. Any final thoughts, y'all?
I mean, first final thought, production quality with all the king numbers.
Yes.
Hands down, everything in that. And then, you know what? One thing I want to tie into, because it's bringing up the character we hate the most, Snipes.
Ugh.
But here's the thing. That end sequence where Edmund is laying there and they think he's dead, but is
whatever. When he's perished. They're like, this boy has perished.
The thing that really caught my attention this time around was you actively see Snipes and Peepers bond and grieve together.
Yeah.
Like, you catch them, they hold each other, they know it's something sad. And I sat back and I went, I remember thinking that they're there for each other back then. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, no, you can not like someone, but in a moment of sadness or whatnot, you can find common ground.
I forgot that kid died. Like, I remember as a kid, Peepers being like, he was such a handsome little boy.
He's breathing, but you could see him breathing. So I don't know if he actually died. I think I don't know.
All of the animals were like, rip, rip. This young boy has perished in our animated world. And I was like, oh no.
One of my final thoughts is just owls are really that horrible sometimes.
Owls are dicks.
I love owls. They're like gorgeous creatures. And, you know, if they're not hooting too loud at my window in the summer, like, I love their hooting. But, like, they are monsters.
Yeah. Oh, my God. I just, like, realized there's so many kind of – well, I guess this is kind of like different tropes from the original play, but I even got some Jesus Christ Superstar energy from this show, and that like there's this kind of prominent star. I mean, it's also the Bible, but in Jesus Christ Superstar, he's sort of this like rock star like character. And then these sort of like, you know, in certain interpretations of the musical, there's sort of this like music producer-esque characters that's like, we got to take him down, like AKA Judas. Everything I know about the Bible as a half Jewish girl is from Joseph and the Technicolor Dreamcoat and Jesus Christ Superstar. But it really, like, I thought that was so interesting and smart to like have a commentary on control and like management and like advocating for yourself. And as you know, people who Nick and I working in the performing arts, and of course you, Sarah, like working in this industry and like working with a lot of like high profile people, and us knowing what the industry has done to a lot of these child actors, and oh my God, Harvey Weinstein, and our person that we hate from Nickelodeon, Dan Schneider. Like, I thought this was just so interesting that as kids we were exposed to this. Like, it was such a, like I knew, oh, I need proper management and representation if I become a Vegas chicken star. Like, that was a lesson from this film, which is so weird. But cool.
I 100% learned that from so many different, like, all the ones you just mentioned, films from my childhood. And I mentioned on the last pod that I did not go into theater or acting, but I did do a little bit of like commercial auditions and like, you know, the YMCA productions of things. And even then I was like worried about it. I was like, I need to make sure that I have someone protecting my rights and like advocating for me.
So you know how, like, I'm totally cosplaying Edmund right now. I've got, like, the same orange color hair. I look like a cat. I've got these, like, big glasses on. I was a child actor. I feel like my aesthetic is, like, Edmund in the streets, Goldie in the sheets. Like, I feel like the same way that Erica Jane from The Real Housewives has, like, a very sexual alter ego. Like, that's my new life motto. Maybe that's my new Twitter bio is, like, Bobby Hill – in the streets, Goldie in the sheets, and people are like, purse. Goldie Hawn? Like, no one will know what I mean but us and the listeners of this pod.
I feel like I'm like a less aggressive peepers in the streets.
Ooh, yes.
And a Chanticleer in the sheets.
I'm a peepers rising. I think.
There we go.
What about you, Nick? What is your astrology rockadoodle sign?
I would say oh my God, what are the three again? It's moon rising and then sun, right?
Yeah, it's like who you identify, like you can be 50-50 of two people and then like a rising character.
I'm Patu rising, by the way.
Oh, Patu rise. Oh wow. Okay, oh, girl. See? That's why
I'm a Patu sun. And then I think I'm a Goldie moon.
Yes.
And then I'm a Chanticleer rising.
See, I love how we all know our type. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like having worked in theater, Nick and I are like, you know, if we go to an audition, we know what roles we are being looked after. I feel like this really, knowing the two of you as well as I do, we really get it in terms of astrology and rock and doodle.
I feel like this needs to be a new segment on this pod.
Yes.
Every single time we need to do this, the astrology of the show.
Oh my God. I feel like we've done this maybe one time before on the show, and now this is an official staple of the show. Like,
yes.
I'm
officially going to go into Canva and make like a template for our posts when we post these.
Oh my God. I love this. Nick, you just experienced the birth of a segment. Congratulations.
Oh my goodness. I didn't even need an epidural.
Nick, where can people find you on the interwebs and check out? You mentioned to us earlier that you had done another movie podcast that I'm sure people will want to listen to.
Absolutely. So I'm on Instagram and Twitter under Slick Nick Q. It's an old nickname, but it still runs. And I recently was on the Brokenhearted Blockbuster podcast. It's a podcast that a friend of mine, Jill Collister, started last year because she unfortunately, in the middle of 2020, went through a divorce. And this was her way of trying to cope with it, to talk about not only people and their brokenhearted stories, but then either the movies that got them through it or just movies that brought them joy in their life. So I talk about one of my first heartaches. I talk about Hocus Pocus in that. And then she talks about having an empowerment song. So things she adds to a Spotify playlist so people can listen to it.
And I love that.
Chloe, you'll appreciate my two songs because my first song was a badass song and it was Eye to Eye from a Goofy Movie.
Oh my God, I listen to that one. I want to pump myself up.
It's my energy song. And then my one where I was like, this fits more to the moment. I said, You Don't Own Me by Leslie Gore, but specifically the Bette Midler, Goldie Hawn, and Diane Keaton one at the end of First Wives Club because the best ever.
Yes. But yeah, I have to listen to this podcast. That's such an amazing concept. And I just like, we'll have to have her on the show too. That's such a cool idea for a show. And you did Hocus Pocus on there?
I did. We literally dissected everything of that movie.
Incredible. Oh my goodness.
Definitely going to be listening to this.
Well, I don't know about y'all, but I need to go outside. It's very dark out, and I need to yell out to my neighbors once again. He can't hear me. He's on a fucking shark right now. What the hell?
Salute Your Sports is not endorsed by the companies featured in this episode or any of their subsidiaries. It is intended for entertainment and informational purposes only.
All names, pictures, audio, and video clips are registered trademarks and or copyrights of their respective trademark and or copyright holders.
Mix and Master by Dr. G.
Our theme song is Keep Me Entertained by Maddie McGuire.
Salute Your Sports is recorded in front of a live house plant
and in a shed
and is not produced in Nickelodeon Studios at Universal Studios in Orlando, Florida. We'll be right back.